For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right, we are in Mark chapter 10 and verses 1 to 12, which, as the title would indicate, has something to do with marriage. We've been talking about how in the last couple chapters that Mark's gospel has gotten a lot more focused, and he's now talking about the march down south, the march towards Jerusalem, the inevitability of the cross, the meaning of the cross as the place where God ransoms his people or buys them out of their slavery to their own sin. And that is the centerpiece of why Christ came. That's the centerpiece of the gospel, is God's movement towards us, God's willingness to give of himself all that he has, which is his son, so that through his death we could be made right with God. And then with that is a corresponding truth about living the gospel, living the good news, which Jesus says is just exactly the opposite of the way that we're taught to think. That we're taught to think that greatness is being on the top of the pyramid, and as we talked about last week, greatness from Jesus' perspective is the place, the one who takes the place of the servant of all. And so he has these wild paradoxes that just seem so counterintuitive. To gain, to save your life is to lose it, and to lose your life for my sake is to save it, he says. That's chapter 8. In chapter 9, he's like, the greatest of you will be the servant of all. That's a really cool abstraction. Exactly what does that even mean? I think about something like that and think, well, that's kind of right up there with what's the sound of one hand clapping or something like that. You know, just one of those weird truths that you can't get your mind around. Well, in chapter 10, Jesus is moving right into this application of what does it mean exactly to live out the gospel. And to live out the implications of the gospel in relationship. And so, in chapter 10, verses 1 to 12, Jesus engages the question of divorce and marriage. Let's pick it up right here. It says in verse 1 that Jesus left Capernaum and he went south to Judea and into the area east of the Jordan River. And once again, crowds gathered around him. And as usual, he was teaching them. Okay, that's the context. Then in verse 2, some Pharisees came and tried to trap him with this question, should a man be allowed to divorce his wife? Okay, well, first thing we need to notice, it's a trap. And so it's one of those things where the religious establishment had basically concluded that Jesus, in teaching against the traditions of the rabbis, had offended them, that he had to go. They are looking for occasion to have him arrested or just some way to get him out of the picture. And so what they choose here is the issue of divorce, and they ask the question, is divorce permitted? Now, that may not seem like an earth-shattering or incriminating topic today. It was back then, and certainly it was in Jesus' time. You'll remember, for instance, the forerunner to Jesus' ministry, that's John the Baptist, got into a heap of trouble, got his head handed to him over the question of divorce because he singled out King Herod and said that his marriage to his niece Herodias was immoral and wrong. And so I think these religious authorities, and most commentators are on board with this thought, that they're trying to get Jesus to say something publicly, kind of like John the Baptist did, and so there would be some reason than to alert the household of Herod, the Herodians, to say, hey, John the Baptist, who you did away with, the guy that came after him saying exactly the same thing, you got to round this guy up. And that's almost certainly what's going on. It could also be true, though, that these religious authorities are really trying to put a wedge between Jesus and this massive popular following. Because if Jesus answers this question with a very restrictive definition of what's permissible in terms of divorce, then he's going to have masses of people who are basically saying, I can't follow this guy. There's just no way I can live that way. Because in the ancient world, you know, there was the tendency to move through marriages when you're able, just as they are today. And so they really are trying to paint Jesus into a corner. And what does Jesus do? He says in verse 3, he answers them with a question himself. Beware when Jesus asks the question. And he says, what did Moses say in the law about divorce? Well, he permitted it, they replied. And he said, a man can give his wife a written notice of divorce and send her away. Okay, so now they're getting the legal question kind of out on the table here. What does the law of Moses, which is binding on Israel, what does the Old Testament law teach about the issue of divorce? And it says that there is a provisio in the law that a man can issue his wife a notice of divorce and just send her on her way. And that's exactly right. That's a citation from Deuteronomy chapter 24, verse 1, where it says, if a man marries a woman, but she finds no favor in his eyes because of something he discovers about her, and which is very vague in the original language and in translation, and he writes her a letter of divorce and sends her away, that's the passage that they are referring to here. It's the only passage that in a straight-on way in the Old Testament law, curiously enough, addresses the issue of divorce. Now, I thought a long time ago before researching this that that's, the Bible has so many rules that surely there was a bunch of them that had to do with divorce, but not so. This is kind of it. And really, even here, it's not about a rule anyway. He's simply stating a fact about divorce, not issuing any kind of permissible grounds for divorce. He's just saying, look, if a man marries a woman and she finds no favor in his eyes because of something that he discovers, and he writes her this letter of divorce, just sends her out, I divorce you. Okay, and that's kind of how it goes from there. So he's not saying, well, it's permissible under this condition or that condition or the other condition. It's a very general kind of principle about the fact that in a corrupt world like ours, with screwed up people like us, we can anticipate that there will be this thing called divorce. And so, but the scribes are trying to go a little bit deeper. And they have definitely a position on this. You know, the heart of God is not for divorce. And Malachi, the last prophet of the Old Testament, he puts it like this in chapter 2, verse 16. He says, I hate divorce, says the Lord, the God of Israel. Well, you can't be any more clear than that, right? I mean, position taken. I'm not into this. I think that's a bad thing. And we're going to talk a little bit about why that is in just a little bit. But the point is that the Bible is quite clear on this point, that divorce is not something that really resonates with the heart of God. But the scribes of Jesus' day, in looking at this passage and translating this passage out of its native Hebrew and into the language of the people, which is Aramaic, a document that they refer to as Targums, which are just, you know, these kind of like loose paraphrases that are highly kind of interpretive and theological in nature, that kind of show us what the heart of the people is. Here's how the scribes took Malachi chapter 2, verse 16. They say, if you hate your wife, divorce her. That's the same verse. Yeah. Shaka-laka-locking. I mean, what is up with that? Well, what they're doing is they're just breathing their own point of view right into the text itself. That's where they're coming from. And they're just waiting for Jesus to say something inconsistent with that so they can bust him out. Well, Jesus isn't that stupid. But this does reflect the dominant thinking of the religious people in Palestine in Jesus' day, and certainly, more broadly speaking, throughout the Greco-Roman world, the non-Jewish people. And so we can read household ordinances, as they're sometimes called, by the great thinkers of the first century world and other thinkers in Roman history. Cicero and other of these great seminal figures would write these like advice columns to married people. And in every case, every single case, the household ordinances were all about the obligations of wives to their husbands, children to their fathers, servants to their masters. And so that's the whole framework of the ancient world as it relates to this issue of what are our expectations for marriage. And it was very easy in the scope of the Roman world, both the Jewish and the Gentile side, for a man specifically to get out of marriage for virtually any reason. Now, Jesus responds to this. Jesus responded and says that Moses wrote this command for a reason, namely only as a concession to your hard hearts. So what is Jesus saying? He's saying that the law is not just some bizarre abstraction, some ideal picture of wouldn't it be nice if. That's not the way the law of the Old Testament is written. It really is written to give guidance to a people who already have an established social order. And it's God's way of trying to move people from where they are to something closer to who He is and what His intent is. So when it comes to issues of divorce, the focus in the law of Moses has to do not with what legitimate grounds exist for a person to divorce their spouse, and specifically for a man to divorce his wife, but rather as a provision to the one that's left. That's what the law of Moses really focuses in on. That's why there is this thing called, well, we call it a dowry. In the ancient world, they call it a mohar. And what is that? It's a bridal gift. And so there's a certain amount of money that a man, if he wants to marry a woman, has to give the family. And some people kind of cynically look at that and say, well, what that is he's buying a bride. No, not really, not at all. The intent for that is if they get married and he turns out to be a loser, an abusive jerk, that she's got a fallback position. That's what that's all about. And so a certificate of divorce is required, which says basically it's not on this woman that I'm sending her out. There's a dowry that she has to return to. There's a framework that God had in mind to protect vulnerable people from the sin of others. And that's what Jesus is saying, that the whole discussion about divorce in the law is really about. Now, but he wants to go beyond that. And he says, okay, that is what divorce is about. But you really can't even talk about the framework for even thinking about divorce apart from what does God say about the purpose of marriage. And that's where his first but clause goes. But, he says, verse 6, and then citing Genesis chapter 1, the creation narrative, God made them male and female from the beginning of creation. And he says this explains why, and now he's citing Genesis chapter 2, a man leaves his father and mother and is joined to his wife, and the two are united into one. And since they are no longer two but one, let no one split apart what God has joined together. Now that's how God has defined what marriage is. And what we need to do is break this down a little bit so that we can more deeply understand his teaching about about divorce and the concept of marriage. There's good news when it comes to marriage from the Bible's point of view. Marriage is held in very high esteem, and it's rooted in a promise that a man leaves his father and his mother, and he is joined to his wife, and a new household is established on the basis of the promise that the man makes to the woman, and then in response to the woman to the man. It's a promise, and that's a very important thing for us to think about when we talk about what is a marriage. It's a totally unique commitment. It's saying, take the most important relationship you have, your family, your mom and dad, your siblings, and then without ignoring your relationship with them, you move in with this other person and you begin a new household. And so your needs for security, your partnership in life, all of the things that existed in your earlier household, now you take this up with the person that you marry. Just one person, just you and that other person. And we're beginning a new life together on the basis of the promise that we make to each other. And that's very significant because intimacy requires trust. You know, marriage is a union of a man and a woman together in the most intimate of ways. But it requires trust. And this is why promise precedes intimacy, and we don't understand that in our culture. Now, I got a teenage daughter, so I'm privy to really rotten teenage chick flicks. And I saw one the other day that disturbed me quite a bit. I think it was supposed to be some sort of a comedy. There was nothing funny about it. He's just not that into you. That movie, that was one of the most disturbing movies I have ever seen. And it's all about how women are willing to just compromise themselves. They are just using each other in these mutually parasitic relationships. And that's somehow called love. And that's what the world has to offer. And it was particularly, I think, interesting. They were describing this couple, you know, who'd been living together for 7 or 8 years, something like that. That was cool with the guy. He was all right with that. Why? Well, because he's getting what he wants without the burden of commitment. And she is feeling used, but doesn't know what to do. She has to just jealously hold on to what she's got so she can never press the M word with him. And so it's just all about this sick negotiation where there's really no trust in the relationship at all, and it begins to fall apart for them, as it does for any relationship where we're seeking intimacy with another person and using that intimacy as a basis for commitment to them. It just works exactly the other way. It works exactly the other way. And this is why our culture is killing itself in the area of relationships that do not work. We want to have that stimulating bond. We want to have that person who regards me as the most important person in their life. But we know we can't have it because there's no trust. There's no commitment. It's a real problem. Promise precedes intimacy. From the biblical point of view, and this is what he's getting at here, we enter into a covenant with one another. A covenant that is based upon what we call, in marriage ceremonies today, vows. Right? Vows. It's what we promise we will do in that relationship. In that sense, it's very biblical. Because marriage is not about guarding jealously my rights. Marriage is really all about responsibilities. From the biblical point of view, the question isn't, are you getting what you really need or want from your spouse? That question is not asked. The question that is asked is, how are you loving your spouse? And so, in the New Testament, which also has its household ordinances, just like the ancient world had them in Judaism and in the broader Gentile world, in keeping with the gospel, in keeping with the thought that the greatest of you is the servant of all, the household ordinances of Colossians chapter 3 and Ephesians chapter 5 center on not what are my rights in this relationship, but what is my responsibility in this relationship. And Paul says something that is fundamentally without parallel in the ancient world. To men, he says this, husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church. Not husbands, make sure that your wife is respecting your authority in all things, and if she isn't, toss her out. He says, husbands, here's your responsibility, that you love your wife, not in some sappy, sentimental way, not in a purely erotic sense, although that's certainly a part of it, But you lay down your life just as God in Christ has laid down his life for you. That is your responsibility. That is the greatest, taking the place of the servant of all. Very powerful. But you can see that Paul, like Christ before him, just sees that the whole way that we look at these things in our culture is so twisted, and so parasitic, and so dehumanizing. And he just puts it right back the way God sees things, because this is the way God is. And that's what makes marriage work. It's rooted in a promise that I'm going to be this kind of person, not that I expect you to be that kind of person. It has long been said, and is no doubt true, that women marry men thinking they can change them, and men marry women hoping they never change. You know, so you're just driven by those expectations, and it just doesn't work. Okay, second, he says, and the two are united into one. And here's that picture of real intimacy. Two lives coming together in this extraordinary way where it's just like, you know, I don't live independently of you. Now, I've not lost my identity as a person, but in reality, we have come together and now we share one life. That's intimacy. And there's a synergy in all areas of our lives that we share. And so in a marriage that's going God's way, where that unity really is there, there's a unity of purpose. There is that idea that I am for you, I'm behind you, and I know at the end of the day, you've got my back, you're for me. And we just are able to think big and have a vision for what is it that we can really accomplish in this world and the things that God would have for us as a family and as a couple. You know, we can work that out together. And couples, I think, realize often that we are much stronger in the context of our marriage than we ever were when we were single. Because we've got that kind of synergy going. And just to know that I am for you, to know that the other is for me, there's something very positive about that. That's really awesome. There's also some vulnerability here, isn't there? Intimacy requires vulnerability, transparency. You can only get so close to a person based upon how much they're willing to show of themselves to you. Right? And so if you want real intimacy with another person, hey, you're exposed. Right? So all that stuff that burbles on in your head, the person with whom you share this intimate bond, they know that stuff. And for some weird reason, they still accept you. They still think you're all right. But there is that need in the framework of unity to allow yourself to be vulnerable. And when you allow yourself to be vulnerable, what? Oh, man, you are really opening up the distinct possibility that you could get burned, hurt. Some of us have been so burned in this area of our lives, we just have maybe even given up on the thought of having intimate relationship with other people because the cost is just really too high for us. That's what it takes, God's way. But intimacy is not a negotiation. It's not a, I'll meet you halfway, something like that. It's that I'm not looking to you, and what is it that you're doing for me? I'm thinking about, what am I called upon by God to do, and moving into your life, into your world. And that's how that intimacy operates. It's not a halfway point. It's I'm in all the way. Now, thirdly, he says in verse 9, let no one split apart what God has joined together. And here we have this truth that marriage really is a supernatural thing. It's the work of God. What does marriage tell us about God? Marriage tells us that God is love. Marriage tells us that God is not just some impersonal energy that emanates the universe, but God is a person. that God values relationship, that God has experienced relationship forever in the three persons that make up his being, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. In this sense, God, you could say, is pretty much an expert on this topic. And that our capacity to experience love and our capacity to make two worlds come together in this intimate bond and to be able to have a victorious marriage relationship really is rooted in God Himself. So marriage is a supernatural thing. Marriage is a spiritual thing. Marriage says a lot about who God is. And marriage also is a God thing. It's an instrument that God uses in our lives. I love the oft-repeated phrase of Martin Luther. He said, you know, marriage is the schoolhouse of character. Most of us have no idea what a jerk we are until we get married. It's in the framework of that intimacy that exposure happens, right? And whereas on the one hand, I used to be able to be this happy-go-lucky guy who, when I'm interacting with my wife-to-be, you know, I'm always on my best behavior. There's always a choice for us to be together, right? I'm thinking about her. I'm kind of pumped up on endorphins or whatever that stuff is. That probably not that. It's probably something similar to that, but different. Then you marry this person, and no longer are you at this place where meeting up with them is a choice that you're making. You're stuck. You're there, man. Bad breath and all, man. It's just all there. And you begin to realize my fuse is a lot shorter than I ever knew. I'm a lot more complex than I was ever in touch with. Man, I got problems. Oh my God, do I have problems. Because I'm not able to easily make this thing work. I mean, she just keeps getting upset with me. I'm okay with me, but she's not. What's up with that? And then you begin to start connecting dots in your life and you realize what she is saying or what he is saying to you about you just happens to really well correspond to and explain a whole range of experience in your life. The things that you struggle with and the failures that really are there. And so you are exposed. But exposed in a very sweet way. Who are you exposed before? The person who says, I'm in there with you for the long haul. I'm for you. I'm in your court. And so in this way, marriage is a wonderful provision from God to begin to experience life change. And it's not the only provision from God. And certainly, people who are not married can have those same dynamics operating in intimate relationships outside of marriage without any doubt. But that is no doubt. There is only one person in a married person's life who has said till death do us part, and that's the person that you marry. So there's that long-term view and that long-term process of life change that happens in marriage. And it's in that sense, it's a unique thing. And just that ability to experience cool things about forgiveness and reconciliation, stuff like that. You know, that happens in a marriage that's going God's way. And it's very sweet. And I highly recommend it. But Jesus isn't done with his conversation. And he's laid out, you know, we can't talk about divorce until we talk about the real heart of what marriage is. But then he goes on in verse 10, he says, later, when he was alone with the disciples, they brought up the subject again. And he told them, whoever divorces his wife and marries someone else commits adultery against her. And if a woman divorces her husband and marries someone else, she commits adultery against him. Wow. Wow. Yeah, it's interesting. He saved that for their alone time. Those are tough words, people. You know, what does it mean? What does it mean to divorce his wife, to divorce her husband? This is the hard part for us to really think through a little bit here together. Let's first think about, what is Jesus not saying? What is Jesus not saying here? He's not saying that there are never legitimate grounds for divorce. He's not saying that. An unfaithful spouse clearly is a grounds for divorce. There's no doubt that dangerous, illegal, immoral behaviors on a spouse's part that threaten the security of the family is a reason for divorce. We can think of perhaps a number, neglect, abandonment, things like that would certainly constitute reasonable grounds to terminate a marriage at a certain point. And we think maybe with too much emphasis, like the audience of Jesus' day, about the grounds for divorce rather than some of these deeper issues that this is about. What is Jesus saying? Jesus is saying, look, just because something's legal doesn't make it moral. Just because you are allowed to do something doesn't mean that you should. There's a difference between what the law permits and what morality requires. Those things are just different. There's lots of things that are legal for us to do in this world and in this society that are immoral. And so Jesus is trying to get past the legality issues and into the realm of the moral and of the personal. The intent here, by virtually universal accord and by commentators, I think it's clearly the case, is that he is referring here to circumstances where a person wants to leave their spouse for another. That's the intent. And marry another. The "and" here being sequential. I'm done with this person and I want to start with this person. And he says, look, you know, you can do whatever you want to justify that by the law, but if you're just quitting on this relationship so that you can begin another, that's wrong. That's immoral. That is adultery at that place. This is very, very tough language, isn't it? You know, we do in our culture a lot of cost-benefit analysis. We live on the business model of relationship, don't we? And when we get to that place where the cost exceeds the reward, what do we say? Excuse me, I'm out of here. And so we have no-fault divorce, and we have a whole frame of reference that basically says, look, you know, maybe you gave it a shot, maybe you didn't, whatever, it's time to move on. And I don't want to say this glibly, and I don't want you to interpret it as that either. Because I'm aware that when we talk about subjects like this, we are evoking enormous levels of pain in lots of people's lives. Many of you here tonight have been divorced. And you know what that's about. You know what that is. How that feels. And I don't want to in any way express a lack of compassion for the very real pain that brings. But the equation that drives our culture's attitudes about marriage are not consistent with the call of Jesus to the gospel. Are you thinking about divorce here tonight? Been in this marriage for a while and it hurts. And it's just been so long since you felt like you had real common ground with that person. That the sense of warmth, the idea that we're really behind and for each other, just, you know, it's not there. And we're left in this hopeless place. We wonder, you know, am I just resigned to a life of misery? Is that what it is? Maybe when the kids are gone or whatever, that would be a good time to just pull the plug and move on. Now, I know that people here think that and struggle with that as Christians, and we wrestle within our conscience, and this is a profound and debilitating experience in our lives. And we need to think about that. Are you thinking about divorce? Think about that. What is really at stake, and what is the Lord calling on you to do in your marriage? I'm going to return to that in just a second. I want to talk in more forward-looking terms here for a second. Because there is the world's approach to intimate relationship, which is temporary and self-serving, and which is why we're having this discussion today and why we had it 2,000 years ago with Jesus. But grace paints a very different picture. In the realities of the real struggles that you and I really do have in our marriages. And I want to urge you that grace means moving toward reality and not away from it. What I mean by that is to realize, you know, maybe I'm in a marriage, maybe I am outside of a marriage, maybe I'm divorced now, but that pain, you know, it's not going away. I've been hurt because I was vulnerable and I got my trust violated. You know, that is the most intense kind of pain that a person can have. You feel a sense of guilt, like, you know, I should have found a way to make this work and I took the easy way out. I quit. Well, that's very hard to just ignore, because that is a very real failure. Maybe you're one here tonight who really suffers with and struggles with the thought that I trusted this person and now I'm rejected. And we question, do I matter? Every person in this room has people in their life, every one of us, who are experiencing what I'm describing right here. Every one of us. Unless you live under a rock. You know, when we feel pain, just like when our body feels pain, the way to deal with that pain isn't to shoot up Demerol. You can do that, but you may die at 50. All right? Pain is a sign that something is wrong. That's what pain is. And it's important for us in the context of marital pain or marital failure and the pain that comes after that. And all of these feelings and things that burble on in us, and that's a short list. There are many others as well. We've got to address those things, because if we don't, we're going to take them into our next relationship. That's why the divorce rate for second marriage is twice the divorce rate for first marriages. And the divorce rate for third marriage is twice that of second marriages. It's because there is an open wound that is not being healed, that is simply being carried on then into another relationship. And when the stimulation wanes, the problems that we could never deal with before are right back there, except we've got more fatalism because we know what failure looks like. And so the gospel brings us to a new foundation. And it says, look, this issue of guilt, this issue of your failure, God understands that. God understands that, and that is why he went to the cross for you. To the woman that he talks to, the multiply married woman in John chapter 4, Jesus offers her living water, forgiveness, reconciliation with God. Not a wagging finger, this type of thing. And maybe this is one of those areas where we just feel like that we have that segmented away from our thing with God, just because we cannot go there. We're embarrassed. We're ashamed. We cannot come to the realities of our failure. And God is saying, that's the law. That's performance. The gospel says, you come to me with your broken life and allow me to forgive. Allow me to wash your conscience clean. Allow me to enter into your life to give you both an outlook about love and about marriage, an ability, a power to affect those ideals that you cannot have on your own. That's the foundation that God has to offer. It is when we yield ourselves to Him and we experience His forgiveness, His mercy, then we are able, we have the resources then to turn around and to share that with our with people with whom we are intimately connected. We love because He first loved us, John says. There is a foundation. It doesn't matter how deep our failures have been. There is a foundation to be restored and to have something that's beautiful and good and transforming in our intimate relationships and in our marriages. And so I want to just close with the thought that grace brings with it a new opportunity. The future does not have to resemble the past. Grace says that God is about a new thing in our lives, and there is a new opportunity. And specifically, what does that mean? It means that we've got an opportunity to live out our intimate relationships and our marriages in the context of a Christian community that reinforces the things that it takes for us to be able to develop those love skills to succeed in marriage. Man, we have this idea in our culture that marriage is this tribal little bubble. It's just my thing and your thing, and we just keep the world out because we got our own little Garden of Eden at home. Oh man, it's a toxic waste dump. Phew, does it stink. And what we need is the fresh reality of people who are struggling just as we are and learning just as we are to rely on the resources of God's Spirit to effectively love our spouse. That very unnative, unnatural work of laying our lives down for the betterment of them and sometimes at the expense of ourselves. It's interesting when Paul talks about marriage, as he does, for instance, again, in Ephesians chapter 5. In verse 21, he talks about the marriage relationship, but in an unbroken way in verse 20, he's talking about relationships between men and women in the Christian community, in the body of Christ. He says, be subject to one another. And then he goes into the marriage and says, wives to your husbands. Husbands, love your wives. If you're trying to make your marriage work in a vacuum, you're just depriving yourselves of the sweet things that God has to offer. You know, we have this thing where we can't, we can't show our foibles, you know. Man, if I'm seen for who I am, then nobody won't want to be around me. You know, this type of thing. Man, when we begin to have those relationships in the Christian community where we are trusting one another and really being subject to one another, then we are being able to have living openly, and God is able to really provide for us the kind of insight that we need to make our primary and our home-based relationships actually work. You know, it's when we are struggling in our marriage that our first impulse is to say there's really something fundamentally wrong with her. And well, there is something fundamentally wrong with her, but that's not going to help you. What really is going to help you is when you realize, hey, there's something fundamentally wrong with me. And so it is in our suffering and in our failures in marriage that God is saying, I'm so glad I got your attention. Because now you have something to turn from and trust me with. That's the lesson we need to be learning. And lastly, that as we are moving toward our spouse with patience and with real principle, you know, no, I'm not going to be a doormat for you. No, I'm not going to just comply with your sinful, self-destructive way of living, whatever. I'm prepared to discipline. I'm prepared to separate. If you reject me, I'll accept divorce. But I will not just idly stand by and watch you self-destruct. I'm going to move towards you. Man, though you don't feel like it, it's been my universal observation about the scores of troubled marriages that I've been pretty connected with over the last 30 years, that people have a lot more power in their marriage than they ever realized. Power to affect real godly change in the spouse. And I want to urge you, man, this is costly love. This is the greatest being the least of all. This is losing your life to find it. But it is so sweet and so awesome to be able to stand under grace side by side with that person to say, man, our marriage is a trophy of God's mercy. And there is something sweet about that and attractive about that. Let's pray together.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.